history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that really ought to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Fresno, California, with 96-year-old Joe Garabedian, Army veteran of World War II, recipient of the Purple Heart, also an owner of a combat infantry badge. We're going to find out how long he lasted in combat and what he had to endure to make it home and start a business that's still with us today and bigger than ever. But Joe, let's go back to your early days. You grew up on a farm, 20-acre farm in Fowler, California, in the Great Central Valley. What was life like back then? How different was it from what we know here today in 2020?
Well, I have to correct. This was in Lone Star. I called it an oasis. We had a canal running on one side. We had the railroad running on the other side, so it was kind of civilization. Thank God for the canal. I learned how to swim, and that came in very handy in the service.
Here I thought I'd been everywhere in the San Joaquin Valley and knew every little spot on the map. I don't think I've ever heard of Lone Star.
Lone Star is 7 miles from Fresno and 7 miles from Sanger. Right in the center, there was a depot there, and it was Lone Star Grammar School on Fowler Avenue as the Santa Fe Railroad track.
And you had a big family.
Yeah, a family of 12. I was number 9. It was very interesting every night to have 12 people in the house. And we all had games to play. It was fun. We had 3 cows, 2 horses, 15 sheep. Armenians all love sheep, lambs, so... We had plenty of chickens and a couple of goats. We never were hungry. We worked. We learned how to farm. And from there on, my brothers went on to town to work. I was left to run the ranch. And when I graduated, I went to work at commercial manufacturing the next day and learned how to weld and do torch work or whatever. Worked there for about a year and a half, and I got drafted.
Do you remember in those early years having some ideas, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this or this? Did you have some of those dreams that young boys sometimes have?
Oh, I had a dream that I was going to work at commercial manufacturing for the rest of my life. Never dreamt of starting a business or anything like that. I was very happy that I found a spot because jobs were a little hard to find at that time at 2 bits an hour, 25 cents an hour. Mm-hmm. And that was very interesting.
And, you know, most of the people listening to this didn't live through the Great Depression. It's really hard for them to fathom what that might have been like. I just heard you say that you had everything you needed out on the farm with all the animals you raised and the crops and all that. But do you remember seeing some devastation around you or seeing times change?
Definitely. You give a farmer a go-ahead and they'll produce whatever you need. We produced almost everything. I don't remember of anything that we bought from town except probably some special meat orders or something like that. The rest of it we produced ourselves. Our garden on that 20 acres was one whole acre. And my mother had, by the time fall came, she would have 4 levers of 12 foot in the cellar where they put all the canned foods. And we had canned foods, we had dried foods, we had bins full of flour. That's why I called it an oasis.
It sounds like it. I'm sure that as one of those 10 kids and one of the younger ones, you probably still had a lot of chores to do, right?
Yes, milking cows morning and night until when they'd calve, then naturally you didn't milk them for a little bit. But otherwise you had that chore every morning, every night. It's a little bit hard to qualify for school projects. I'd have to tell my dad, will you please sign this contract so I can get to play football? And he said, no, there's no money in football. I don't want you to get hurt. Well, I'd catch him when he's reading the Bible and catch him when he's starting to cry. And I'd say, would you please sign this for me? And he'd sign it. So next thing I know, I was on the football team. Buying somebody else's used football shoes. But you know what I loved about football? Walking on the concrete with the girls watching. That's what the interesting part was.
The heads would turn, huh?
Yeah.
What position did you play?
Right guard and right tackle.
And who was your big rival?
Sanger. Selma. Selma's the one that ruined us.
They ruined you.
It was on the kickoff. They run the ball back, and that was it. That's all it did. The score finished 6-0. Otherwise, we would have won our gold footballs.
I'm thinking about just the timing of everything. Since you were the class of 1942 at Fowler High School, that means that just about in the middle of your senior year, the world changed a little bit. Do you remember December 7th and where you were?
Oh, well, I remember. I was driving a Fortune tractor on the back of the 20 acres. They motioned me on, and I stopped, and they said, this is about 1 o'clock in the afternoon for us here. And when they said what they did, it was very hard for me to believe, because our neighbors were Japanese, and we were friendly with all the Japanese here. We went to school with a bunch of them, and it's just unbelievable. And we went back to school. A speaker came one day, and he said, none of you boys will ever see action. Well, he was very wrong. We got right in the middle of it.
I just always want to imagine what it's like for you. I'm sure that coming from an Armenian family, you had grown up with stories of the persecution that the Armenian people had faced that drove so many of them to the valley. Your family came over before 1900. But I'm sure you had felt some of that, or at least heard some of that, that there'd been some discrimination or some persecution of Armenians?
All during our grammar school, up through the 5th and 6th grades, we were persecuted by certain people. We would eat our lunches behind trees because they were wrapped in Betsy Ross wrappers that we saved off the loaf of bread, sometimes Armenian bread, sometimes Armenian cheese. We just took it. Whatever they gave us, we just didn't fight or nothing, just carried it on. Thank God. And today we married each other.
They picked on you and called you names and stuff, or what?
Yeah, Fresno Indian. But as far as playing in sports, we were equal with anybody else.
And I bring that up just as I'm thinking about watching what then happened to your Japanese-American friends. Because as you just said, these are your classmates, these are your teammates in sports, and then they're gone.
Yes, I had to deliver their strawberries to the association because they could raise them, but they couldn't go to downtown. This was kind of the bad part of my. I visited them at the
Assembly Center?
Yes, right here in Fresno. At the fairgrounds. I visited them before they shipped out. But when they came back, some of them took a pretty good beating. They had to sell their properties and such. Some of them just ran the ranches for them, which was a very kind thing to do. It was something that wore off. Everybody got back friendly again.
Well, and here it wouldn't be too long till you're over fighting Imperial Japan. But these are Americans. These are kids born in America just like you. As I said, they're your classmates. And I want to ask you about that because you just said something. And people who know the story, they know that, you know, initially their movement was restricted. Then they were sent away from the West Coast inland to these internment camps. So when they couldn't go to one side of the freeway, you volunteered to take their goods to market so they could still make the money from their farm.
Yes, Yamamoto. His father and my father were the first ones in the neighborhood. Later on, the Japanese had trouble buying property, but before then he had bought the 20 acres, so they were good people.
So they had the farm adjacent to your farm?
20 acres in between.
Okay.
It was sad because they were our friends. But it all got straightened out. But some of them took a hell of a beating.
Many of them lost everything they had.
Yep. There were a lot of greedy people out that took advantage of it.
Well, it's good to hear about some of the exceptions and the kindness you extended to them. And so then you finish out high school. And had you thought at all at that point when you graduated, had you thought at all about getting into the service?
No, because I was in 41, my junior year, I worked at commercial manufacturing, so I knew I was going to work there for the rest of my life. But after being there another year and a half, I had to leave. I thought I was going to join the Navy, but I was colorblind. I went through 19 years of my life without knowing that I'm colorblind. And now I remember why, when I was picking peaches for the Lehman family, I'd hear the owner hollering out, who's picking these green peaches? Because the red peaches were taken to the market. So after I got discharged, I went and told Adam, I said, Adam, I'm the guy that was picking your peaches green. I said, that's not the only place I had trouble. When we started business on 220 electricity, there's four wires. One is green and one is gray, and I had a little problem. We did hook up electricity. It was pretty bad. I saw the signal okay because I know the top light is red and the bottom one is green. But I got through. But that was because of this reading the semaphore, which was so oftenly used in the Navy.
Right. That's how they communicated.
For communicating. But I went to Dr. Pomeroy. I says, you got to give me some pills. I'm colorblind. He leaned back and laughed. He says, son, you're born that way. He says, there's nothing you can do about it. But they put me in Army 2, which goes the same place that Army 1 goes, but I could see camouflage better than the average person can. I never put it to use, but I never had that trouble on colors in the service.
You did end up in the Army after you tried to go in the Navy, but you didn't have to. You could have stayed right here in California because your farm was something that the nation needed. People needed food. The soldiers overseas needed all those raisins from here in the valley. Why didn't you think a deferment for agricultural purposes was the way to go?
Four other of my friends did. I couldn't. I was coming out of a bachelor spell at that time. I told my dad, I said, I have to go. I won't be able to stay here. And thank God I went, because I love this country. I love what it's done. I'm sorry for all these people that are protesting now. If they knew any better, I wish the protesters would just turn around, go home before the door could hit them in the back. It just hurts me. This is the most wonderful, beautiful country in the world. You know how many people we've lost during all our wars, especially the Civil War, brothers fighting brothers. I don't like the protesting that's going on.
You end up in the Army. Do you remember what your expectations were? What did you think it was going to be like?
Every morning when you wake up, you dig a slit trench as long as your body and as wide as your body. And it rained so much in those islands that water would fill up to the top and start to flow off. So you're soaked in there. And the order is you do not stand up to go to the bathroom. I met one of the guys that got shot in our outfit with a .45. He didn't die. He stood up to go to the bathroom. And when I saw him on the hospital ship, I said, "Hey, Bill," I said, "what the hell are you doing here?" And he said, "Oh, some sniper got me." I knew what had happened, but I never told him that one of our guys saw him stand up, so he got shot. Mm. Now, the foxholes, wet. You're wet. You're there until the sun comes up. We had set our machine guns, 8 machine guns, 2 feet off the ground so that it would shoot over our infantry. And when the Japanese would come in with their bonsai, like 200 at a time, we had our machine guns all set ahead of time. So one guy would sit and stay awake. Now, believe me, we fell asleep in that water. It was your time was up. You'd take a handful of mud and throw it and hit the other guy, so his turn to go to bed, and it's your turn to stay up. Thank God I had only 8 days of this.
Yeah, we're going to hear why it was limited to 8 days. I'm also interested, too, in what led up to your heading overseas. Because I know you weren't a machine gunner right out of the gate. You have to go through training. You're learning a lot of different things. And some of the guys I've talked to had a more jarring experience in training than others. What was it like for you?
We went right direct from Fresno to Monterey and then took a train to Camp White, Oregon, and put right into the company. That company was on bivouac, which means regular war experiences. So those of us that were put in there to fill up the holes were there for about 2 weeks before they came in. And I knew enough not to try to out-talk these guys and argue them, because that's the time for you get in trouble. They came in, we got all fit in. I was on 383rd for a month or so. And then, for some reason, they chose a number of us to put into the mortar platoon and the machine gun outfit. And I was fortunate enough to get into the machine gun outfit. And one main thing that I remember, they threw out a 2-inch rope from the ship to shore. This is in practice. And we had 20-foot waves. You got one hand on the rope, you got the other hand on the tripod over your neck. And thank God I did not lose mine. I said to myself, "Garabedian, you will not lose this tripod." Some of the mortar guys lost their bases because they're so big. When the wave hits it, it just throws them all over the place. I'll never forget that. You had to breathe only when you thought you were in air. You didn't know whether the water is still in close to your mouth or where. Anyhow, we had a bunch of those occasions like that.
Those practice landings were on the Central California coast by San Luis Obispo?
Some of them were here in San Luis Obispo. Some of them was in down where the Marines are, Camp Pendleton. And that's one where we had to climb to the top. I don't know what it was, 20 foot, 30 foot up. And you got 70 pounds of pack on you. And you're climbing up a net rope ladder, and you got to walk across the top or crawl across the top and start coming back on the other side. And lo and behold, somebody drops his weapon, and the Marines just wouldn't let us live it down. How bad are you guys going to be? You guys going to be our supporters? We don't want to fight with you guys. Not if you're going to drop weapons. It's just one. We got our tail out of there and left. It was ugly. But some of the other training was on Oahu, Hawaiian Islands. We spent a month there at Pali Pass, Maui Island. Most of that was amphibious. I didn't know what the word amphibious was until I found out that our spies had gone to Singapore and seen the Japanese landing crafts. Our landing crafts were boats, real boats with keels. But this was a flat-bottom twin diesel engines that were very powerful, that would carry about 50 people. Now, if you got 500 people to a ship, three ships to a division of 15,000, you can see how many trips that coxswain had to take back and forth. Well, fortunately, when we landed on Leyte, there was no beach fighting. We were kind of tickled about that. But the coxswains were very happy, too, because they can back off and bring another load in. You can imagine, they had to make quite a few trips. That was a hectic time of the war, whether you're going to make it or not. And your question was, what do you think about? What do you think about every morning? I'm still alive. Will I be alive tonight? Four of my outfit died. Why am I here? I'm right there. I got shot through my brachial plexus, which are all your nerve center, and come out and just missed my spine.
That sounds pretty serious, doesn't it? There are a lot of people who wouldn't be here if that had gone a little differently, and a business that might not have revolutionized the world's food processing industry the way that Valley Welding and Machine Works has. We're going to touch on that and what it took for Joe Garabedian to recover from his injuries when we come back. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video with Joe, and Hometown Heroes will come right back after this.